there's a current of consolidation that's flowing through the industry. And the more I learned about DSOs, I think the more conviction I developed that they're not all bad, but they're not all good. And maybe there would be a way to step into this current of consolidation and pick and choose the best practices from the ones who I think are doing it well and nudge the industry in a direction that's better for dentists, for patients, for the communities that these practices serve. Again, DSOs aren't all bad, but sometimes they get wrapped around the axle on making decisions with spreadsheets. And that sometimes makes sense if you're trying to roll a bunch of practices and sell them in 5 years. But our model is one where we're making long-term investments in dentists and practices, and we're trying to invest in people that will eventually take care of patients, and the profits are going to follow. That's the idea.
Hey there, dental economist. If you're a dentist owner or a leader within a dental business thinking about growing production, case acceptance, patient and staff satisfaction, positive outcomes, and everything else that comes with running a dental business, then you're a dental economist, and you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Dental Economist Show. We're meeting at the intersection of profit and purpose as I sit down with dental leaders who share their stories about dentistry, business, and growth. Welcome back to another episode of the Dental Economist Show. I'm your host, Mike Huffaker. Joining me today is Ryan McCausland, the CEO and founder of Tailwater, an organization that buys majority stake in great dental practices and then provides a comprehensive array of non-clinical management services. In this world of DSOs and struggling independent ventures, Ryan and his team want to give opportunities to practitioners to flip the script on DSOs, which includes a path to partnership for early career dentists. Ryan is keen to help dentists flourish professionally and personally with a firm eye on the patient end as well, summed up by the statement, people, patients, and profits in that order. So Ryan, welcome to our podcast.
I'm glad to be here, Mike.
You know, there's lots of places we can go with this. I was checking out your background on LinkedIn, and I thought it was fascinating. So you spent over six years as a professor. Walk us through kind of the journey from academia to dental.
I did teach classes at Vanderbilt University, my alma mater, but it maybe looks more impressive than it actually was. I wouldn't describe myself as an academic. I did teach a class of seniors annually in their senior capstone class that prepared them for work after college. So I'll tell you, I loved being in the classroom, Mike, and I hated grading. There may be a day when I return, but for now, this chapter is exclusively dedicated to, building Tailwater and earning a reputation for helping create the best careers in dentistry.
That's fantastic. So you founded Tailwater 2.5 years ago. Tell me about what you set out to do first. Like, what was your process and how did you go about kind of establishing this group?
I can tell you, I bought the URL and I bought a Tailwater hat before we ever had our first practice. And that took some chutzpah. But so far it's worked. 4 years ago, I didn't know what a DSO was. But I have a buddy in Houston who's a dentist, Dr. Reynolds Lawnen. And I remember he's about my age, I'm 41. And maybe 5 years ago, he bought his practice. He was an associate there and he bought in. And I was excited for him and congratulated him. And in a conversation, I said, is it kind of just the case that now that you're 35, 36, your classmates are buying into the practices that they're a part of, the natural way that dental practice transitions work, or so I assumed. And he told me he can count on one hand how many of his classmates from NYU dental school ended up buying in. And that surprised me. And he told me what a DSO was. And I was so interested in the macro trends that were driving this consolidation, because what we're seeing today is what everybody recognizes, right? There are fewer transitions to independent owners than there ever have been. There's a current of consolidation that's flowing through the industry. And the more I learned about DSOs, I think the more conviction I developed that they're not all bad, but they're not all good. And maybe there would be a way to step into this current of consolidation and pick and choose the best practices from the ones who I think are doing it well and nudge the industry in a direction that's better for dentists, for patients, for the communities that these practices serve. Again, DSOs aren't all bad, but sometimes they get wrapped around the axle on making decisions with spreadsheets. And that sometimes makes sense if you're trying to roll a bunch of practices and sell them in 5 years. But our model is one where we're making long-term investments in dentists and practices, and we're trying to invest in people that will eventually take care of patients, and the profits are going to follow. That's the idea.
I found that really interesting. And I noticed that comment as well with the Nashton Company, and that a company looks to invest in service businesses and has that very defined statement that builds leading companies in niche markets over a very long period of time. And I would say that that is unique in the space and is probably something that sets you apart from some other private equity business. Can you talk a little bit more about that philosophy and why you feel that that's important?
It's no secret. There are a lot of private equity-backed DSOs out there, and some of them are great, but they have a very strong financial incentive to roll up as much EBITDA as possible and then sell it at a higher multiple in 5 years. And some of that results in unnatural behavior that doesn't quite align necessarily with the interests of the dentists, of the teams at the practices, or certainly not the patients. I'm not saying they all behave that way, but I can say with confidence that the incentives exist for them to behave that way.
And what are some of the outcomes of that behavior? Like, can you go into a little bit more detail of what you've seen? And as you mentioned, not all DSOs are the bad guys. And there's, you know, we have an expression like you've met one DSO, you've met one DSO, because there's so many different models for operating. But what are some of the downsides that you might see in those incentives being aligned in that manner?
I think that model runs the danger of creating a revolving door of associates who come in and learn how to practice dentistry with an intention of leaving. And when they do that, it degrades the integrity of the practice that in some cases have served the community for decades. So they still offer maybe good clinical dentistry, maybe, although you often have young associates who are learning on the job who have incentives to put a crown on everything because their compensation is tied to it so dramatically. But I think there's a place for that. It's good for patients because, you know, most of these private practices aren't open on Saturdays, Mike. You expand access to care with models like that. There's nothing wrong with it. But there also is space in this industry for a group like Tailwater who can come in and partner with dentists in a way that preserves the souls of these practices that have been around for decades and serve communities that want to come and feel the same way they always have, like things are being done for them, not to them.
Absolutely. How many practices do you all have currently?
9.
I noticed also on your LinkedIn, you talk about, you know, growth and culture. You have a newsletter, which is awesome. We'll get into that in a second. When you think about culture and you think about the 9 practices that you have now and your growth in the future, what are some of the keys and important things to make sure that you are consistent with moving forward to enable the positive culture that you're looking to achieve?
I'll start by saying that we have an advantage of no timeline and no finish line. And so I can be selective when it comes to the kinds of practices who I want to invite to be part of Tailwater. And I can be patient. If we don't acquire any practices this year in 2024, that would be fine. Our model will still work. Now, I'd like to bring on a couple more practices because I'm excited about what's happening in the industry. And I think that if we believe a practice is going to be better with Tailwater than they will with some other DSO, we're going to be able to do that with them. But I don't have to for the spreadsheets to look pretty. And that's nice. Now, to answer the question you asked more directly, Mike, we're selective when it comes to the practices that we want to invite to be part of Tailwater. And some of our criteria include things like partnering with dentists who are high integrity and already have a system that works. We've looked under the hood. We like what we see. That doesn't mean that we can't grow it further together, but it does mean that we don't have to come in and sort of switch everything right away. Like, because if I put my cold-hearted capitalist hat on, we're getting the cash flow that we paid for, and it doesn't matter to me which practice management system they're using. We do a good job, I think, on the front end of assessing not just community reputation, which can be done very quickly by looking at how many 5-star Google reviews they have. That's a good start, although that can be hacked too, so you have to be careful. We also talk to the teams, and we insist on meeting the teams and having them be aware of the fact that there could be a potential partnership happening well before we close. Because we want to get a feel for what the soul of that place is. Is the kind of place that we walk in and we know that people are going to be taken care of. Because we've all been in dental practices where you can feel it when you walk in. So the financials are a table stake, right? The spreadsheets need to look like they're moving in the right direction. And we need to feel confident that these things are profitable. But beyond that, there's this secret sauce that so far we've been really good job of assessing so that we know that after closing, the people who are going to be on those, again, working on side of the practices are going to be good partners.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, hey, look, we don't need to affiliate or purchase any additional practices this year. Like, that's not something that is a requirement. As such, you're allowed to be selective. And you said something about, but if I see that there is a value for another practice to join us and to join Tailwater, then, you know, obviously you want to pursue that. What are the values that the practice gets from joining Tailwater?
On some level, it's the same stuff that DSOs offer, regardless of who you partner with. Like, I think we do a pretty good job of this sort of operational blocking and tackling. Some of these things are table stakes. We run payroll and we get it right. We keep them compliant. right? We handle legal, we handle accounting. Like these are things that no matter who you partner with on the DSO side, like they're going to be able to do for you, or they should. But beyond that, I think part of the reason that our dentists who are choosing Tailwater are doing that is because we're giving them a clear path to trusting that their practice is going to be under good stewardship. We're going to take care of their people. We're going to help make sure that whoever steps into the practice as a successor, as an associate to start, but ultimately a partner to us, is going to match their values. And to the extent possible, hold up, right, the legacy or whatever is important to that practice. We want to culturally match the dentist who's going to be the successor with the founding dentist.
Do you set up succession plans kind of prior to a dentist looking to retire? Is that something that is a process that you put in place that the owner of the practice who's kind of built that up over years is able to exit feeling and knowing that all of that hard work and all of those patients are going to be treated well post-retirement?
Yes. And I think that's probably worth double-clicking on, because when we buy a practice or buy a majority stake in a practice, we do that sometimes knowing that the dentist selling the practice might just be around for 2 to 3 years. And we're okay with that. We happen to be pretty good at recruiting early career dentists and talking them into joining this thing that we're building together. And in addition to, you know, acquiring 9 practices over the last 2 years, we've also recruited 6 early career dentists.
What's your approach to that?
I'm not sure that we reduced it to a science, Mike, but it's working. So our approach to that involves things like we ask the dentists who are part of this thing to help us spread the word and find good people who share our values. So we rely a lot on our team of 90 people across these 9 practices to sort of help us recruit. And then we look at matching clinical skills up or complementary skills. I'm so proud. Dr. Ryan McCormick joined Fisher Family Dentistry in Hendersonville, Tennessee in September. And this is a practice that is already thriving. I'm so proud to be affiliated with Fisher. Dr. Kelly and Dr. Scott Fisher do impressive collections numbers, but I can tell you they referred out $1 million of endo last year. It's a lot of endo. And so we recruited Dr. Ryan McCormick, who moved to Nashville from Baltimore with his wife, who's an orthodontist, and he stepped into this practice. And Ryan McCormick knows how to do some endo, Mike, and he does some implants. And as a result, right, he's a clinically skilled dentist who went to dinner with his wife and my wife and Dr. Kelly and Dr. Scott Fisher, and we all got to know each other. And our courtship was probably 5 months long before he said yes. But then when he ultimately moved and joined this practice, it's been really fun to watch the growth, because the team trusts him because he's a good cultural fit. The patients trust him because he does great clinical dentistry. And the doctors who started that practice love him because now they're not referring out those cases that they previously were sending to a specialist.
The industry right now is really struggling with hiring and finding clinical help and associates, and really just across the board inside dental practices. Have you also had some of those same challenges, and how have you been able to overcome that?
I think that this industry challenge can be flipped into a competitive advantage if we get it right. On some level, I believe that Tailwater Dental Partners is an HR business, and our job is to recruit and retain the best people. And if we can do that and then surround them with support that they need to thrive, like, we're going to do just fine. It's not to say the rest of the execution is easy. It's not, right? We need to get that right. But we need to build that upon a foundation of getting the right people in the right seats. And so, yeah, we struggle with it. I can tell you right now, if anybody's listening out there, we have 2 practices that I'm really proud of. One in Rolla, Missouri, Rolla Family Dentistry, led by Dr. Jeremy Kears. He's crushing. He has 8 operatories. He only works out of 5. They're booked out 6 months in advance. They get 60 new patients a month because it's the best practice in the county, 7 years running. And Rolla, Missouri is the home of the university. They do really well. He has 3 empty operatories waiting for the right associate. More patients they can handle. And so we're not just going to put a warm body in there. We're going to find somebody who's really the right fit for that community. But if anyone listening thinks that they know somebody who could be the right fit in Rolla, Missouri, I mean, we're setting them up to crush.
Sounds like a great opportunity. I think I had seen you mention that about the belief that Tailwater really does provide that HR function. That's one of the most important functions. And I think people in any organization is at the heart of your ability to succeed. And HR is such a backbone to that. I don't think I've heard somebody word it in quite that way before, but it makes a lot of sense. And as you say, you know, there's a lot of components of what you can do to support your practices as a DSO that are kind of considered table stakes, but it's really the devil is in the details. And that's what separates one group from another. And if you can really execute well on the HR part, I think that would be a significant differentiator in the space compared to some others that are predominantly focusing in on operations or maybe some of the other changes at the practice level. I'm curious, do you guys rebrand all of your practices, or do they retain the same branding and naming as they were when the acquisition happened? How do you think about that and about creating Tailwater brand and becoming known as such?
We don't rebrand our practices. Patients don't know that Tailwater exists, but we're trying to earn a reputation among dentists, hygienists, practice managers, office managers, assistants, as the place where they can have the best careers in dentistry. And so we very much want to establish a brand in the industry, but I'd be surprised if patients out there ever know that Tailwater exists as a part of the practice where they visit.
And are you guys regional? You know, you just mentioned Missouri, and I know you're in Nashville, I believe. What from a geographic area? Do you have a focus?
We do. I can say that for now, I have a wife and three young children who love me, and I'm trying to keep it that way. So I won't get on a plane to go see a practice. We have big dreams, and so I expect there's going to be a day when I'm not the only one going out there to talk to these practices. And when that day comes, if someone wants to go to Texas, Wyoming, you name it, we believe that we're playing a long game, and someday we'll be everywhere. But for now, I want to be able to drive to the practices and back. And so our regional focus is really 4-5 hour radius around Nashville, which includes 5 different states. Right now, we're in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Missouri.
And do you find that that creates any synergies between the other locations and the practices? Do you have any type of gatherings or meetings across all the practices? And do the doctors and clinical teams know each other?
Yes. So there are a couple different ways we facilitate that. The first is some of our practices are really close geographically, and they were aware of each other as friendly competitors prior to both joining Tailwater. And so we have situations where assistant calls in sick at the last minute, but a practice nearby is able to give one up for half a day and manage. And so we're able to share some of those resources across practices, and that helps. How many of our practices have been in situations where an assistant can't show up and you have to call patients and cancel? This reduces the likelihood that that happens. That's been really helpful. We have one hygienist who works across 3 practices. And so that's part of the strength of being a part of a group, is if you can sort of share those kinds of resources. Other ways that we make sure they know each other include, one, our practice managers meet biweekly on Thursdays for an hour. And they don't all show up to every meeting, but usually they're virtual. Every once in a while, they're in person. But we give them an opportunity to work with their peers, learn from each other, share best practices and challenges, right? That's another advantage that comes with being a part of a group. We had a Christmas party the last 2 years in Nashville. I'm so proud that most of the people came. And we put them up in a hotel, the ones who had to travel, right? But still, they came. And so we're able to spend some time together where we're not just talking about clinical dentistry, Mike. And I think that's an invisible glue sometimes that holds this thing together when things get frustrating or go sideways, which they inevitably do. Dentistry can be really hard. The last thing I'll say is I send out, I'm not saying I do a great job of this, but I am very disciplined about sending out an email to the entire team every Friday or Saturday, which I call the weekly KPI, where KPI stands for keeping people informed. We're not talking about average daily production or case acceptance, but we're sharing news across practices that can be celebrated. Sometimes it's just somebody's getting married, man. Sometimes somebody's kid got a scholarship, and we're all excited to share that together. And I'm told that people actually read it.
Nice. That's great. Speaking of KPIs, we mentioned managing through a spreadsheet and that can be the path that is taken with other private equity groups. But measuring matters, right? And it's still important. So aside from keeping people informed, which I love, what do you measure your success by?
I say that we don't make decisions exclusively with spreadsheets. And I mean that. Our decisions are informed by people and principles, but we measure everything, right? Like, that doesn't mean that we don't measure. It just means that we sometimes take into account the nuance beyond what's showing up in the KPI. And that, I think, is an important distinction. Now, there are any number of KPIs that managing a dental practice can be driven by. We have 5 that I paid the most attention to, and it took us a long time to figure out what to Tailwater really matters. And so every Monday, our practice success team, which is what I call the equivalent of a corporate team, our practice success team, we get together for a weekly review on Mondays where we look at how we did last week, where we're moving in the right direction, where we might be faltering. And when we recognize an opportunity to sort of offer some guidance, it's gentle, right? We'll get in touch with the practice manager and a dentist, and we ask, hey, what happened here? You good? Because if there's cancer, let's catch it early. But it's always a conversation, and it's just us doing a good job of holding everyone accountable for the standards they've set for themselves, right? All these practices who are part of this want to grow, want to be the best version of themselves, and it's our job to help them do that.
Yeah, you're not seeking to hold somebody's feet to the fire. You're looking to provide support, guidance, opportunities for improvement, keep an open dialogue, understand where they're struggling and where they're doing well, and try to help problem solve.
It's no secret, right? Part of the advantage of being part of a group is sometimes you're able to get lower pricing on labs and supplies. That can be a big driver. And we're able to now, like this is going to be really familiar to anyone who's been part of a DSO or a DPO or a group, but maybe sounds like it would be a big asset to anyone running a private practice. I mean, we see what works, man. Like, we know which practices are running on 8% supplies and labs combined, and we try to figure out what they're doing right. And then to the practices that are closer to 15%, we just sprinkle some of that fairy dust and say, what if you tried this? Maybe you need a Cerec melt. Maybe you'll get the exact same product from this vendor. So zero change in quality, but for half the price, right? We see examples of this all the time.
You mentioned there was five things that you track. Would you mind sharing in a little bit more detail what those five things are?
I can, and I can tell you that I didn't make them up. You know the Bulletproof Dental Practice guys? They have a podcast that I listen to.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Okay, so this comes from them, but I've really embraced it. The things that we track or that I think help us assess the health of practice include things like reappointment rate. So active patients with appointments divided by total active patients. And we want to see it above a certain threshold. We look at production per visit. So net production divided by total patient visits. And that we believe measures the efficiency of appointments. We look at utilization rate. So this is one that's a little more complicated, but we look at net office production divided by the total number of operatories. So if you're 6 ops times 8 hours a day, there's 48 hours in a day. And then you take the net production divided by the total hours. Did I do an okay job explaining that one?
You did. No, that makes sense.
Okay, that's the third. The fourth is treatment acceptance percentage. And the fifth is net growth. So just new patients minus newly inactive patients divided by the total active patients.
What do you find is the most challenging thing in the transition? You know, we talked a little bit about the succession plan, but in continuing to keep a practice operating smoothly when a longtime dentist is choosing to retire, what are you most concerned about or worried about? What are the things to keep an eye on to make sure that you are setting the practice up for future success?
When a dentist retires, so much of the goodwill in the practice is wrapped up in the rest of the team. Sometimes it's a hygienist who's been there for 2 decades or more. Sometimes it's a manager who knows the names of the patients and knows the names of their kids and where they vacation. And so we see our job as preserving as much goodwill as possible by setting up the team for success and making sure they feel like there's a real future and there's energy behind this transition. We do things like, before we ever begin the transition, we have the team go out to dinner with the dentist who's going to be coming on board. We invite spouses. We try to learn about each other beyond just what we're going to be doing clinically. For all the reasons I talked about earlier, this is the invisible glue that can sometimes hold teams together when things go sideways. We try to tell a story about the early career dentist and control that narrative in a way that, well, is the truth, but tells the story out in the community so that then the community will be excited about a transition. And then we write that story just as much for the community as we do for our internal teams, because we want the teams to know, like, here, this is why we're doing this. This is what the future looks like. It's bright. So we are really thoughtful around sort of those things. And then there's all the clinical blocking and tackling and integration and credentialing. And you need to get that right every time, because if you don't get that right, you lose the trust of the teams and the rest of the stuff doesn't matter. It can't be all sizzle, no steak. It has to be both.
So a couple of years in now to the space of building Tailwater, what is something that you really enjoy about dentistry and the industry? And what is something that maybe is an unexpected challenge or something that you didn't expect to be so difficult about this industry?
I love how dental practices and the dentists who lead them can be such an important part of the fabric of a community. The dentists who do this right don't stop doing their job when they leave the office. They coach Little League. They're involved in the local chamber of commerce. They do the stuff that holds communities together, and they earn the trust of the community such that their business thrives. And I believe dentistry as a business can be beautiful when you have this virtuous cycle of dentists who are doing the work that they want to be doing outside of their office just by being a part of the community. And that helps their business thrive. And then their business sets them up to be more of a leader in the community. And you see this all the time traditionally in dentistry. And we'd like to see more of that. We think the best practices are led by dentists who take that approach. That's one thing I love about it.
It's great. I mean, the benefit to society is incredible and it can be really, really rewarding. What is something that you wish was maybe a little different about dentistry?
I think one thing that I wish was different about dentistry maybe is that there needs to be more opportunities for dentists to be owners at the practice level. I think the best practices are led by dentists who are owners, who see patients as relationships and people they're accountable to, not just transactions. And by practicing dentistry that way, the lifetime value of a patient, if we put on our cold-hearted capitalist hat, right? I happen to believe that the lifetime of value of a patient increases dramatically when they believe that things are being done for them, not to them. And that can be hard in the short run, especially as a young dentist is sort of building its or her clinical chops and they want to be able to pay off student loan debt and do as many crowns as possible. I get all that. But if we can all play the long game together, we can build something really special that's better for dentists, their teams, their patients, the whole community.
So at Tailwater, if you're an early career dentist, what could that journey look like? That path to partnership and to having some ownership? What would one expect to experience in that model?
Well, let's use that example I mentioned in Rolla, Missouri, okay? Just as a case study for how it could go. Dr. Jeremy Kears has been at that practice leading it with a lot of success. He has 3 empty operatories that an associate steps into, and that associate gets paid a normal rate, right? Let's call it 30% of net production, give or take, but that's usually about right. And then over the course of those 2 years, that practice grows in value. It goes from being a $2 million a year collections practice to $2.5 million. The dentist who joins that practice as an associate, who's learning from Dr. Kears and also sort of adding value along the way, gets to buy into that practice at their 2-year anniversary, but they buy in at the value of the practice on the day they join. So it goes from being worth, let's just to make numbers easy again, they can buy 30% of a $2 million practice that's now worth $2.5 million. So on day one of being a partner, they're in the money. But I'm willing to take that haircut because we can't do it without a man. And so we really want to be able to create clear paths to partnership for these young dentists who end up becoming owners with us. And we make monthly distributions based on the profitability of the practice.
Yeah. And when you talk about aligned incentives, that's a great way to do that in the most positive of ways. And you're not incentivizing negative outcomes that you don't want to see happen. You're incentivizing better patient care. You're incentivizing better outcomes. And you're also providing real opportunities for people to gain some financial independence, which is an awesome thing. So that's great. I'm curious, you know, I saw you've got your website, you've got a lot of great content on there. You like to write, you do a newsletter. Where do you go to learn? Is it books, podcasts, articles, Twitter, X? What's your mode of choice?
The best money that I spend probably all year is my Audible subscription. So I listen to books, I mean, pretty much constantly. Yesterday, I drove 2.5 hours to see a practice that can be a potential partner. And the whole way there and the whole way back, I'm either on phone calls or listening to whatever I'm listening to on Audible. And as I'm doing that, Mike, it used to be a Moleskin notebook, but now it's just a notes app on my iPhone. But I am constantly just taking notes of things that I want to remember or revisit. And it started out as just one notes app that, now I bet I can scroll down for minutes and minutes. And there's just anytime I want to think about writing, or communicating or reflecting on an idea that we could incorporate at Tailwater, I have this catalog of ideas that I've picked up. And usually it's from books. It could be podcasts too. I already told you I listened to the Bulletproof Dental guys, who I respect. And there are a few others like that. But it can also just be conversations like the one you and I are having. I'm constantly writing stuff down on that notes app that I want to revisit. And over time, it becomes a pretty rich catalog.
Absolutely. I'm curious. This is like a details question, but with the notes app, are you creating separate notes, or do you have one super long note that you just continue to add to?
One super long note, Mike. It's not elegant.
Okay. I've done that myself as well. And I have this like really long note. And my wife is like, everything's categorized in like multiple files. And she's very organized. And she goes like, you just keep going on the same one. And I said, yeah, I just keep going.
You're a kindred spirit. Does it work for you?
It works. Yeah. I mean, I know where to find things too, amazingly. I just scroll up, scroll down, and do search, and like, there it is.
Yeah, it's exactly how I think about it. Like, as long as it works, man, I'm as organized as I need to be for the systems to work.
So what was your, maybe not favorite, but what's a book over the past year, year and a half, Audible or otherwise, that you have, that's made you think? You know, those books, kind of find yourself reflecting on them kind of over and over. Anything in particular that you could share?
I'm going to give you the honest answer, which is a cheesy answer, maybe. I don't know. I'm a little embarrassed. But there's this book by this guy called Parker Palmer called Let Your Life Speak. Very, very cheesy title, I'm aware. Sometimes I think that books can hit you different ways depending on when you read them and where you are in your life. And when I read Let Your Life Speak, I had just spent 10 years at a building what became a tech company prior to jumping into dentistry. And I thought of myself very much as an operator, Mike. And this book helped me develop the courage to say that I'm an okay operator, but I really want to be a CEO. I think building a dental business that has heavy emphasis on culture, clinical and operational excellence, yes. But I'm a culture guy more than a finance guy. And the book suggests, or I guess if I were going to summarize it, it's just that, are you doing the work you were created to do?
No, that's great. And nothing to be embarrassed about. I feel like I've always thought that some books just find you at the right time. Depending on the time that you are reading that, they certainly hit you in different ways. I posted on LinkedIn a few weeks back. We actually do a book club in our sales and marketing organization at Planet DDS. And we've, you know, it's been going on for over a year now. We're on our 9th book.
Well, you go. What's your favorite book on that book club list, Mike?
On the book club list that we read, so two that stuck out to me over the past year that I keep reflecting on. One is called 5 Dysfunctions of the Team, Patrick Lencioni. And it's great. The whole like writing a story in the form of a fable where you get to feel like you're a fly on the wall and observe conversations that you can absolutely envision taking place. And then getting the lessons out of that, I thought it was great. And I've reflected on that book many times since I've read it. The other one is a funny name, but it's called Surrounded by Idiots. And it's effectively about personality tests. So there's 4 different personality types. There's red, blue, green, and yellow. Goes into some in-depth knowledge about each of them and how each of them can work together. And it opens talking about how many leaders are reds, which are like a very decisive personality type. And he'll catch somebody saying, you know, gosh, everyone I work with is just a bunch of idiots. Like they don't know what they're doing. And he goes, well, who's the idiot that hired him? And so, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like, look, people are not idiots. They just have different approaches to the way that they like to be worked with and how you should work with others. And it goes into a lot of detail about that. And it's something that we actually reflect on inside our team when we're working with prospects or others and go like, oh, well, that person's a blue. Meaning they're highly analytical. They need lots of information. They're not going to be quick to make a decision. And we need to support that versus pushing against it. And so that's been another one that's been really impactful for me.
I love that. I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said, I do not like that man. I must get to know him better. And so I think so much of our conflict comes from misunderstanding each other. And a tool like that can be helpful. I do want to mention 2 more books that I thought of. The first is, it reminded me when you were talking about that book, Surrounded by Idiots, I read a book called Multipliers by Liz Wiseman.
That was on our book club. That was 1 of the 9.
Did you like it?
I did.
It reminds me that like lots of people have latent genius who are just, is just untapped. And it's a leader's job to identify like how this person's genius functions and how to draw it out of them. That's the idea. And I hired our first VP of operations last year. His name is Nick Murray. Nick's a star. I love Nick. Tailwater's better because Nick's here. And Nick served in the Navy and he gave me a book called It's Your Ship by Captain Michael Abramoff.
Okay, I don't know that one.
I'd never heard of it. And I can tell you that I had waves of emotion wash over me as I read this book, because this is a guy who took over one of the worst performing battleships in the Navy. And then within 2 years, turned into one of the top 3 as measured by whatever the naval standards are. And he was able to do that because he got this crew of hundreds of people to buy into this idea that it's not his ship, man, it's yours. Accountability and ownership mentality. Like, let's all recognize that if we can all do well together, all of us are going to benefit personally.
I'm going to add it to my list. A last question. What are you most excited about heading into 2024 over the next year? Professional, personal, anything? Just what's getting you excited right now?
I'm so proud of the fact that across these 9 practices that we have today, I believe that we have the hearts and minds of these teams. Not without exception, right? Like we make mistakes every once and again. And that happens. That's part of operating in ambiguity and just doing business. Mistakes happen. We're human. But when that happens right now, I think we've done such a good job of earning the trust of the people who have trusted us to be stewards of their businesses. And because of that, we're able to have conversations we wouldn't otherwise would have had, or we wouldn't have otherwise had. So we spent the last 2 years earning their trust by being good partners and doing the right thing. And now we get to come in and say, hey, I know you've used this lab for 10 years. Would you try this one? Because you can get the same product and save X amount. And so we can only do that. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So we have this foundation of trust that we've built. And now that we have it, we're able to do some things that I believe are going to make these practices more profitable in the long term and really continue to thrive, because we share their incentives and we care about them just as much as we care about the spreadsheets. And I'm proud of that and I'm excited about it.
Well, thank you, Ryan, and congratulations on all the success. And we'll definitely be keeping an eye on Tailwater. And I really appreciate you spending the time.
Mike, it's been a pleasure. Let's do it again.
The Dental Economist Show is brought to you by Planet DDS. To find out more about how cloud-based dental software by Planet DDS helps unleash dentists and their staff to focus on patient care, visit www.planetdds.com. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes by following wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.